Hello and welcome to the Autosport Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas. After a weekend off, Formula One's most unusual season continues this week with the returning Turkish Grand Prix at Istanbul, which is coming back to the F1 calendar for the first time since 2011. The 3.316-mile track is famous for being one of the more popular tilkadromes, helped of course by the multi-apex Turn 8 in the second sector, which produced an exciting challenge for the drivers during the track's initial seven-year stay in the championship. But the cars are much different these days, which may mean a different spectacle at Istanbul. They have much higher downforce levels than back in 2011, and that year, the first season of running Pirelli tyres, the Turkish GP was a four-stop pit stop fest, which also featured 79 overtakes, which is up from 27 a year previously, as the then new DRS combined with the fragile rubber to really ignite a new debate over F1's entertainment factor, had it become too artificial, which still continues to this day. Joining me today to discuss all of that and much more on Zoom are motorsport.com's F1 editor Jonathan Noble and Autosport's F1 reporter Luke Smith. How are you both? It's rather a miserable morning in northeast London for me, looking at the weather outside my window. But at least, Luke, we are now starting the second week of our post-Imola travel quarantine period. So, how have you found being cooped up indoors?
Not actually too bad. I think the fact that the whole UK is in lockdown has actually made it a bit... Obviously, it's a terrible situation, but it's kind of made me feel a bit less like I'm missing out on like going out to pubs with mates or anything like that. It's just is what it is, really. So been making the most of it. It's not actually too bad. Down in West London, now I've moved across the city. It's quite a nice day. So it just is what it is. Like, ultimately, we can't do anything about it. It is the quarantine. We're getting through it. And hopefully we'll have some good racing this weekend to get stuck into before finally getting some freedom next week. I look forward to it.
Indeed. Luke revealing there how he's gone up in the world of late by moving to West London. But anyway, John, how are you doing? Are you looking forward to this weekend's Turkish Grand Prix?
I am. That's not very good English. I am, actually. Turk is what? Yeah, is one of the Tilka tracks that was a success, was good, but travelling there and going to the race is always a bit of mixed feelings, because you've got this great layout, that the Turn 8, spectacular, good corners, good elevation, but the track's in the middle of nowhere and always was a nightmare to travel to or drive to. The options were staying in Istanbul, but the bridge over the Bosphorus was invariably jammed with traffic all the time. And I remember one year... our designated driver for the weekend, whose name shall be redacted, basically just adopted the policy of whenever a police convoy went past in the hard shoulder on the log jammed motorway, he would just basically just duck in behind it, follow them all the way through, go through the toll booths with all the alarms blaring off, and we were expecting a massive letter from the car hire company at the end of the week with all these numerous tolls not having been paid, but never heard anything. So great success.
Oh, Luke, maybe that's what we should have done when we were stuck in that traffic trying to get into Portimao. That would have worked a treat. There we go. Anyway, sorry to bring up terrible memories. John, am I misremembering? I thought Istanbul was one of your better places to go from a conversation we'd had during our epic and very enjoyable trip between Spa and Mugello. I thought you enjoyed visiting that city, or is it just the sightseeing? The location is great, but just the track access is terrible.
In the end, we stayed in a we abandoned staying in Istanbul. It got too much, the traffic. You could get stuck. If the name redacted driver wasn't in charge of the car and busting the toll booths, then it would take you an hour and a half to get into Istanbul, and you'd be stuck for an hour and a half going back out. It would be impossible to have time to go for dinner anywhere because taxis were just stuck. So we found a town near the circuit, which basically flew into Istanbul airport, jumped on a bus to a ferry port, and got a boat across the river to the other side, and then picked up a hire car there. So it was all, I mean, it was fine. It wasn't a complete disaster, but it would be amazing to have this track near a bustling city that was easy to get in and out of.
It certainly would. But I don't think getting in and out is going to be much of a problem this weekend, because there are no fans in attendance. Turkey had initially wanted or expected up to 100,000 people to attend, which during a pandemic might not have been the most sensible thing to happen. But yeah, Luke, what is the latest on the sort of the situation surrounding the Grand Prix and how events are going ahead, getting everything set up?
Well, yeah, as you say, no fans are going to be there. Obviously, it was an aim of Turkey, and I think they quite ambitiously said that 100,000 target, and F1 were quite quick to say, that's Turkey's target, that's not our target. And I think they were maybe expecting some fan levels around sort of the Portimao kind of number, which I think was about sort of, that again was planned to be about 40,000 to 50,000 a day and got cut in half. And even with that cut in half, did bring about all the travel hectic chaos that you did mention. And it's but they did announce a few weeks back there would be no fans going to the Turkish Grand Prix, which is a shame. I think a lot of fans were sort of targeting it as an event to get to. Obviously, a lot of new fans to the sport as well, thinking maybe about a lot of the Max Verstappen fans, for example. I think they were quite excited by the idea to get to a Grand Prix this year, to go and see a new city in Istanbul, to get to a new track. But obviously, that's all been kiboshed as sort of the pandemic is appearing to be on this sort of second wave across Europe and into Eurasia as well. So, so that's the state of play, really. But hopefully, it'll be a very sort of safe and trouble-free weekend, and that everyone can get in and out of Turkey all quite smoothly, and we can just carry on with the season and get this round completed.
Absolutely, and of course we echo that sentiment, hoping it all goes off without a hitch this weekend. Luke, what are your memories of watching the seven races that did take place at Istanbul when it was on the F1 calendar full time? Was it a race you particularly looked forward to watching?
Yeah, it was actually, because I mean that joined the calendar in 2005, and I first started watching F1 in 2006, and I was like, my mum was a big Ferrari fan, so I was into Ferrari as well. And obviously Felipe Massa was absolutely brilliant around Turkey. Like, I think he got three wins there, I rightly recall, and he was a real force. So I think I always quite looked forward to it sort of from that sort of fan perspective. But it was just a really cool track, as John said. And I think that one of my favourite F1 onboards, if it's not too geeky to have such a thing, is of
It is a little bit. Okay. But we'll let you off. That's fine. That's fine.
What's number seven on your list, Luke?
Touché. It is Kimi Raikkonen's pole, and I shared it on Twitter this morning, Kimi Raikkonen's pole lap from Turkey in 2005, because that was, I think, the first real look at the circuit. And you've got Kimi in, I think, the peak of his career. That McLaren in 2005 was brilliant, if a little unreliable. V10 engine, and it's just a really, like, really cool lap. So I really like the circuit. I played it a lot on the video game. It was always quite challenging. And I just think it's really cool. Like, and it's kind of track that I thought, similar to Imola, that I would never get to go to or work out or see F1 at during my career, because it's sort of a thing of F1's past. And obviously disappointed not to be going this weekend. But it is, it's just really cool to have another sort of classic track on the calendar. And as John said, sort of one of the better tilkadromes for everyone to get stuck into.
Just to come back to your favourite onboards there, Luke, I think, to be honest, one of my favourites, probably the favourite, is Kimi Raikkonen's onboard when he gets called into when he gets called in for a pit stop at the British Grand Prix early this year and has a very sweary rant at his engineer. But there you go. John, just coming back to the 2011 race that I referenced in my intro there, because I thought, well, my column for Autosport magazine and Autosport.com Plus this week is going to be about Turkey, funnily enough, and perhaps what can the current field learn from the last few visits, what type of racing the track tended to produce. And it was really interesting reading up Autosport magazine's first of all that the leader that, you know, gives a flavor of what to expect from the issue and perhaps comment on events in motorsport of the week that we tend to cover, and the report from that race, because it was one of a bit, it was, the tone was a bit of annoyance, really. It was like, well, hang on a minute, what just happened there? As I said, 79 overtakes, four pit stops for everybody, because that was the first year of the Pirelli rubber. And I think, you know, that sort of era, I particularly remember China, which had come just previous to this race, being the first, oh wow, these tyres are just going to cause overtaking left, right and centre. But it seemed, from picking up the magazine's sort of narrative, well, first of all, their problem was that so much happened as a result of all the pit stops and all the overtakes, was that there was no real narrative to follow. It was just, right, everyone does their thing, then they stop, then they do it again, and it's sort of, you know, rinse and repeat, as it were. But also DRS had really seemed to become a big factor at this race. It was the first time, or one of the first times, that everyone had a chance to think, oh, hang on a minute, maybe it's a little bit too powerful, maybe it is a bit too artificial. Does that tally with what you remember going back 9 years?
Yeah, I think it was that era where F1 was trying to find its feet and trying to understand what an ideal tyre would be or should be, because we'd had that great start when Pirelli came in. There was, you know, it was a different era of racing, a different approach to the tyres. They wanted them to be high degradation, and on the outside, from a fan's perspective, thought, this is great, we'll have lots of car variability of speeds that will produce overtaking, it will play to the drivers who can look after their tyres more. So if you're too aggressive, you'll burn through them, and it should make a great spectacle. But I think what Turkey illustrated was when it goes too far, that you know, four stops where everyone's having to do far more stops than they would like to do, where you're right, there is no narrative to the race. It's just charge, change tyres, charge, change tyres. You don't get a story to that race, and that beautiful aspect of a Grand Prix where it all comes to a crescendo at the end and you get a spectacular finish because it's all chaos all the way through. So it's a bit, I think it's a bit of an eye-opener, especially because it was a track that was good for driving. It was a track where the cars looked spectacular. So in theory, it should have produced a great Grand Prix, but it was the first inklings of, have F1 gone too far with high degrading tyres, and do we need to kind of rein it back and achieve this balance between a good spectacle and not becoming too artificial?
And Luke, do you think that debate still rages to this day, as I sort of suggested earlier? Because, you know, we could see similar topics come up this weekend. Okay, yeah, the tyres are different. They are still high degradation, but they degrade in a different way, and it's not quite as bad as it was back in 2011. One of our colleagues, who shall remain nameless as well, described the tyres as like camembert back in 2011, particularly around Turkey. But also, you know, DRS is still a thing, although it is much harder for the cars to get close and make passes now that they've got much more downforce. They're much bigger, different types of engines, just sort of different, massively different types of machinery. But yeah, what are you expecting in terms of the racing this weekend?
I think it is correct that the sort of debate about entertainment versus a sort of a purist Grand Prix, that is something that is still talked about. And obviously, I think F1 is very keen to strike the balance perfectly. And they've said they want to make it more of a spectacle. They want to make it more entertaining and serve the fans. But they also don't want to get too far away from the roots of the sport and what makes it great. So I think it's a sort of a fine line that it's had to tread. And I think since the tyres have sort of become a little less like camembert, more of a Stilton, or a cheddar, or a bit of a harder cheese, maybe, that it's we've kind of gone away from that. So I think that hopefully we won't see any sort of repeat of those issues that we had in Turkey back in 2011. But I think I'm just really fascinated to see how the cars get on, because it is just a real cool track. Like, it's as we've already said, one of the better Tilkodromes. You mentioned Turn 8. I think seeing the cars through there is going to be really, really cool. But it also maybe points to how far F1 has come, in that we've kind of asked all the drivers already, like, oh, what are you expecting? And all of them have gone, Turn 8 is going to be really cool, but you're literally going to do your installation lap, not flat out, and from then on you should be flat out around there. And it's kind of a bit like, oh, it kind of sanitizes, I guess, some of the great corners and some of the great circuits, just because of how far these cars have come. But I guess that sort of points just to where F1 has advanced, really, and just what kind of sport it's become, and that ultimately new tracks that join the calendar in the future, what they've got to do basically to remain a challenge for the drivers and be exciting again. So I guess it will just be, I think, a bit like Imola, just interesting to see a track basically from a very different era of Formula One brought into the modern day and just see how it fares.
Absolutely. Well, this track also rather famous for spats between teammates. This is the 10-year anniversary of the 2010 Turkish Grand Prix, where, of course, Sebastian Vettel and Mark Webber, very famously and very controversially in terms of that squad, clashed. Vettel pushed out of the race. Incidentally, have you guys seen the video that did the rounds on Twitter of what happened to Vettel after he got out of the car? Well, obviously, he's on the TV doing his gestures about what he thinks of Webber's driving. But then there's a fan video, which someone shared recently, where Vettel comes back behind the marshal's post, and there's an official who's turned up in not a course car, but like an official's car, to get him back to the pit lane. Vettel actually gets into the driver's seat, and drives back. He literally floors it. The tyres are squealing. It's an amazing video. I'd search it out if you can see it. But yeah, incidentally, also that race where Jenson Button and Lewis Hamilton had a very, very, very hard fight for what became the win, of Hamilton prevailing. Some suggestions that Hamilton was quite surprised at how hard Button raced him there. But then Button sort of, I think, diffused the situation by being like, that was incredible, that was brilliant, and then it didn't blow up to be a bigger thing at McLaren. But then a year later, in that race that we've been talking about earlier, they did exactly the same thing, had a really hard fight, ruined their tyres in that particular stint and made it a lot harder for themselves. And in that race as well, that 2011 race, both the Renault drivers engaged in a great bit of wheel banging through the slow final corners at the track. I think Nick Heidfeld particularly aggrieved at Vitaly Petrov's driving. But is it just a curious aberration of this track, John, that it has a reputation for teammates not getting on in certain places?
It's probably a manifestation of the tyre issue, that you're having to balance the need to not be too aggressive and kill your tires. So your pace is, you're kind of managing your pace to the limit of your car more than being able to push 100%. And then if your teammate is therefore elects to push a little bit harder with a good potential to overtake with a DRS, very powerful DRS, then there's more of a trigger point than there would be at a track like Monaco, for example, where you can't overtake, or even Imola with very few chances beyond a safety car restart. So I think it's just like that. And it probably was an element of both those factors that were important in the Webber v. Vettel thing, and also that, you know, that tension between Mark and Sebastian had been bubbling up for a little while, and it was the first reality of them fighting at the front for potentially a world championship title. And at some point in a rivalry, a clash normally has to happen, basically. It's very rare for tensions to build up in a battle for wins or potentially championship to go that far without there being a flashpoint. I think it's quite remarkable so far that Valtteri Bottas and Lewis Hamilton haven't really had that. There's been minor rumblings along the way, but nothing has yet blown up to the extent we've seen other teams.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly that as you were speaking, and it made me think, even if you go back to 2014, Nico Rosberg, Lewis Hamilton, obviously they clashed 2 years later at Barcelona, but you know there was the incident at Spa where they tag each other and Hamilton ends up with a puncture, and that already, you know, the first flashpoints, and it sort of gets worse from there. But yeah, what are your particular memories of that 2010 race, John? Because obviously, what was it like in the paddock after the Red Bull drivers had sort of taken each other out? Okay, Webber continued, finished third, but it's not going to be the first time that happens in that team's history, because of course Daniel Ricciardo and Max Verstappen clash 8 years later at Baku. Obviously they both end up out of the race, but how did Red Bull handle that from your point of view? What was it? What? How did they react in the media afterwards?
Well, normally in the media centre, you know, during the races, there's cheering and whooping, and some of it's a bit over exaggerated when cars are off and everyone, you know, makes a big ooh. But when you get teammates colliding, journalists love a good story. That we like nothing more than a fantastic story. There's nothing worse than a race where they set off in grid order and they go around. There's no overtaking and there's no narratives. There's no stories. And it finishes. So what we like are races like, you know, Turkey with Vettel and Seb colliding. We like Spain 2016 with Rosberg and Hamilton colliding and Max Verstappen winning. So these are the moments. So when they collided, obviously there was a big, whoa! Then what I remember is John McAvoy from the Daily Mail had seen this incident happen and then just went straight down into the paddock to try and doorstep Sebastian as he came back in. And I think one of the Red Bull guys gave him very short shrift as he came in, all live on television as McAvoy's down there chasing his scoop.
That is actually on the F1 2010 official review DVD as well. So I remember watching that when I was a fan and thinking, oh, okay, that's rather interesting. And then, yeah.
So I remember that. And then post-race, what I seem to recall, obviously quite a way now, is that you have the PR teams trying to manage the situation, trying to keep it all under control. But obviously, just as Mercedes had Niki Lauda, who would throw some grenades into the building to stir things up when he was speaking, Red Bull had Helmut Marko. So while Christian Horner was trying to stay quiet about everything, Helmut Marko was grabbed as he left the track and let rip about all this, the outrage of the situation and who was to blame. So then you've got a team PR trying to manage not only a clash between two drivers that they've not faced before, but they've also got the internal conflict of one of their team members had said something which ramped it up even more. So it's one of those great evenings where everyone's trying to grab opinions and grab quotes and speak to the various people there as all this is playing out. And I'm sure all the other teams are absolutely loving it.
Yes, no, would never miss an opportunity to revel in other misery. But let's move on, guys, to the other notable thing really about this race this weekend, which John, as you mentioned earlier, it's Lewis Hamilton against Valtteri Bottas, and obviously the championship can be sealed at this race, which if Hamilton does it, would be three races before the end of the season, with the two races in Bahrain and then Abu Dhabi still to come. He can do it if he makes sure he's 78 points or more ahead of Bottas coming out of the weekend. He's currently 85 ahead. That's after the race, because that's what will be left remaining on the table in terms of the points available in Bahrain and Abu Dhabi. So, Luke, fairly simple. Do you expect the championship to be sealed this weekend?
Yes. Yeah. It's very straightforward. So what would it take? It would take a Bottas win with the fastest lap, I think, to keep it going to another race. And which, I mean, that's well within Valtteri Bottas' reach. So by all means, he could well do that. But I just think, yeah, the form that Lewis Hamilton is in right now, I really find it hard to look past him sewing things up here. And he's just in a really good groove. And I think that it'll be the fourth year in a row, I believe, he's won it with three races to spare. He always has quite a good knack, even in a shortened season, it seems, of getting things done quite early. And yeah, I just think that I think he's just got everything in his favour right now. I think he's in a really good spot. Obviously, Bottas has got to fight back after the disappointment of Imola, where he struggled with the damage to his car, and that meant that he wasn't able to really have a fair crack at going for the win. But I think that, yeah, this should be where Hamilton is crowned a seven-time world champion, which is going to be a real remarkable achievement. And I think just continue the sort of the debate about the greatest of all time and everything like that, it just adds to the fact that he's statistically now going to become, I think, the greatest ever. And yeah, I'm interested also to see that once it's sewn up, how everything else moves, whether he's like, right, title's done, now I can talk about a contract and my future. But I think that, yeah, I would be surprised if we go to Bahrain and there's still something to play for.
Indeed. And while we're at it, Luke, seeing as you mentioned the greatest, you give me an opportunity to insert an unscripted plug for the Autosport 70th anniversary special issue, which you can now order from autosport.com, which discusses the greatest. That is the topic. It's not, we're not saying anyone in particular is the greatest, although I believe Kevin Turner is doing a feature where he may do exactly that. But yes, that's the topic we examine in terms of Formula One, in terms of all other categories. We've got touring cars, rallying, sports cars, it's all there. Go buy it. It's going to be a wonderful thing. And I'm very much looking forward to reading it. In fact, I've already ordered my copy, although it is going to be sent out free to all Autosport magazine subscribers. John, it's interesting what Luke said there about the fact that Hamilton could potentially wrap up the title with three races to spare in a shortened season, because this isn't the usual massive behemoth, unwieldy Formula One calendar. Because of the pandemic, it's been condensed and shortened, a massively mad run of races. And yet, he still potentially could seal it massively early. So what does that say about his performances in 2020?
Oh, he's been better than ever this season. Not really. I think the difference that's happened this season is that he didn't have much of a wobble at the start of the campaign. Often he comes into the year, not necessarily on the back foot, but things don't gel to the extent that they do normally in the second half of the campaign. So it's probably a bit of a different mindset approach with the condensed season. Maybe just excels in the summer. Maybe when the sun comes out, he's much, much better. And, we got out of spring and the season didn't start till July. So, he's rolled it. I still think, though, invariably when drivers have the first chance at winning the Drivers' Championship, it doesn't always happen. I don't know whether something just clicks in their mindset, or the talk and the build-up to the weekend gets too much. But I wouldn't be too surprised if it doesn't get wrapped up this weekend, just because these things sometimes happen and drivers can trip up, or the pressure just feels slightly different.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you raised there, John. I mean, also just what I find really interesting about the season is going back to what you said about, Hamilton traditionally has these slow starts. He still kind of did when you think about how the Austrian Grand Prix played out. It was just that the fact that the second race a week later, he was straight back on it, nailed the wet qualifying session, and then his season sort of took off from there. As you say, the aspect of what's been notable about the starts through seasons that he's generally made, it just was very, very short in terms of potentially not being completely up to speed, as it were. But look, just coming back to you, it's interesting thinking about Valtteri Bottas, because the further we get away from that Imola race, and it's interesting, I was thinking about our drive, our very fast and very safe drive back to Florence Airport to get us home on that Sunday night. The more I think about it, and because I was thinking about it on that drive, about what I was going to put in my race board, in case you thought, what on earth is he talking about in this bit of the podcast, but there we go. Was just how good Bottas was that weekend. I think, his pace in the first stint, everybody else was sort of suggesting, if Red Bull had known about the debris, they wouldn't have pitted. They wouldn't have pitted Verstappen, and they would have just waited and they could have overtaken Bottas. But nevertheless, he was still extending his gap. He was still producing very, very, very good lap times, to the point where I'm pretty sure there's a Mercedes quote floating around, maybe from Andrew Shovlin, saying we weren't actually sure initially if what we were seeing from the data was correct, because we'd sort of seen that there was a piece lodged there, but his times were still so good that we was like, right, okay, he's actually there. And then they later got it confirmed from the TV shots and pictures and stuff like that, that it was. It was a good weekend for Bottas. Unfortunate, really unfortunate what happened with the debris. But he has no choice now. He has to nail it in Istanbul. And potentially, as we've discussed, in terms of teammate flashpoints, could this be the perfect track for that to happen?
That'd be quite interesting, wouldn't it? So the one weekend where Hamilton can sort of have his crowning glory if Bottas sort of finally gets mean, I guess. And it's something that I think we're all kind of interested in this dynamic in the sort of Mercedes relationship between Hamilton and Bottas. And Bottas has kind of always been this sort of very, very obliging, very sort of accommodating wingman, which is a term that he really hates being used. And obviously was used, I think, once as a slip of the tongue by Toto Wolff and only for that situation. But it's kind of become now, I guess, sort of used more fleetingly about him. And I think that, yeah, it's... But he's been really good this season. That's the thing. Like, this has probably been his best season in F1. And the gaps to Hamilton in qualifying through sort of the mid part of the season were tiny. Like, he was always within a tenth or ahead by a tenth. And at Imola, again, like, he was in really, really good form, managed to grab that pole position, and then was strong in the first part of the race despite this damage. So he's not, like, he hasn't been poor this year at all. Like, he's made some mistakes here and there, but for the most part, he's been very, very close to his teammate. And I think that knowing that he can delay the coronation, obviously it's not something that he'll be like out to do to spite his teammate or anything like that, but he'll want to just have some fight back and get another win up and just try and sort of keep things going as much as he can. And I think what I'd be quite interested to see if we get into a situation in the final part of the race where we've got, say, Bottas leading Hamilton in second, and after a week where sort of things have swung on one vote here or there in the United States, whether the one bonus point for the fastest lap, whether Hamilton might think, well, I'm not going to go for the win, I'm going to back off, get my fast lap bonus point, wrap up the title, and whether Bottas might have to react to that. So might see a bit of sort of cat and mouse gamesmanship between the two of them in the closing stages, which hypothetically could be very, very interesting.
That's a very topical suggestion there, Luke. But of course, in Formula One, there can be no, whether they can, you could protest a result, I guess. Ah, what am I talking about? Yes, the entire situation with Donald Trump, a ridiculous and frankly outrageous situation with Donald Trump, could come true. You could get those ridiculous protests, but I doubt that will happen in Istanbul. And it's also just worth pointing out that if there is a clash between Bottas and Hamilton this weekend, I'm not saying I want that to happen. Of course I do, as a journalist, let's face it. But Bottas has to score. Him retiring helps Hamilton. The only thing that he can do is outscore Hamilton, however it happens. So if he retires from the race, that's obviously disastrous as well. But just before we move on to sort of the last couple of topics on this podcast, John, I wanted to ask for your memories of the 2006 Turkish Grand Prix weekend, taking you even further back in time, because that's another really sort of standout memory of Hamilton from this track. And it's interesting thinking about how much F1 and Liberty Media have sort of changed things, because lots of people are going to see the videos that are going to be put out on social media and at various points about Hamilton's, he was racing in GP2 at the time, his recovery from spinning on lap two in the sprint race, charging back to second place. It goes down. It really, really adds to the early parts of the Hamilton legend, as it were, that race. And, you know, it following on from what he'd done at Silverstone in GP2 and sort of wowing everybody. But can you remember, how did that go down in the F1 paddock? How was it received on the day?
Yeah, I think by this stage, people were kind of well alert. Even people who don't follow kind of the junior categories to the extent that we do. So, you know, a lot of drivers only come on the radar if we're doing exceptionally well in either F3000 or GP2 or wherever it came from. So I think, you know, Lewis's success at Silverstone had really pushed him onto the kind of the Fleet Street radar. As an example, they were looking for, you know, someone who could be up there. Jenson Button had come into F1 in 2000, you know, had pushed on and done all right, but hadn't delivered that world championship at that point that Fleet Street had been used to, with the kind of the Mansell years and the Hill years. So they were looking for this, you know, new superhero to come in. So I think, you know, after the Silverstone success, he was being watched, and then any of these great comebacks from the back always they improve the narratives, don't they? It's sometimes better to spin on lap one, go to the back and charge through and win, then lead into turn one and pull 40 seconds clear and utterly dominate sometimes. So, I think it, by that stage, I think there were no doubts that Lewis was ready for that step up to Formula One. Although I think even nobody could have predicted just, you know, how immediately he would get on the pace, or what a remarkable 2007 we would have.
Indeed. Well, as I said, we're coming towards the end of this podcast. Let's discuss perhaps other news stories that we should probably keep an eye on this weekend. Luke, as you mentioned, obviously, really sadly, devastatingly, coronavirus is on the rise again. We are firmly in the second wave in Europe. And that is having an impact, particularly, definitely, we know, one squad in terms of Williams. They've been forced to change things in terms of sort of the makeup of their team this weekend because of, sadly, some positive cases. So what's been going on there?
Yeah, so Williams confirmed a few days ago that they were going to be changing the makeup of the travelling team for Turkey. As you said, they had some positive cases that did come up. All of the teams obviously undergo the FIA's testing regime, which is every 5 days, that the three of us have all been involved in, as well as sort of participating members of the race weekend. But those, and the figures always reported, always very minimal. It's, I think the latest round was 8 cases or something like that for the previous week. But any testing that teams do outside of that is not recorded. So therefore, we don't actually know for sure what the proper numbers are. And we've heard sort of reports of teams having some more cases than have been reported, particularly at Racing Point, for example. But Williams, I think, and to their credit, been very transparent about it and put out a statement saying, look, we've had some cases. We're going to be changing up who is in our travelling team for the coming weekend. Obviously, we know that George Russell's trainer had sort of some COVID symptoms before Imola. Ultimately, that came to nothing. But it's just good to see a team sort of being very vigilant. So yeah, there will be some changes at Williams. Quite what the extent of it is in terms of who it is, we don't know. But we'll obviously find that out in the coming days.
Indeed. And John, in terms of the wider interest in terms of the driver market, expecting any announcements to be made this weekend? There were suggestions that Gene Haas was seen on the grid at Imola. Maybe he'd flown over to Europe during the pandemic to sign a few contracts. Anything that's obviously pure speculation, but anything you're expecting to happen this weekend?
Well, I think that the next step we're making is Haas to announce his two drivers. I think everyone's agreed that it's going to be Nikita Mazepin and Mick Schumacher, but I don't think that I's have been dotted and the T's crossed just yet. And it may be that Ferrari decides that it wants to wait until after the Formula 2 championship's been done and dusted in Bahrain before making an announcement. If they've already decided that this is the route they want to go to, there's no particular need to rush out an announcement. Potentially, you don't want it to affect, you know, Mick Schumacher's focus on winning that F2 championship if suddenly he's been thrown a lot of F1 questions or switching the focus there. So better to keep his mind focused on Formula 2, get through the Bahrain weekend. He will obviously want to wrap up the championship there. And then what better way to cap that championship than to then announce that he's stepping up to F1 next year. So I think that's the next step. The other big question, of course, is Red Bull. What's happening there? Alex Albon's under pressure to keep that seat. Imola, you know, a bit of a mixed weekend, really. Qualifying wasn't a complete disaster. He was within reach, but potentially not as far up the grid as he needed to be. But the race didn't really make an impact. Wasn't the rear gunner that Red Bull need. And obviously that mistake at the safety car restart was, you know, pretty poor for his hopes of staying on. And, you know, it's another reason that Red Bull could think that we perhaps need someone a bit more experience in. But I'm not expecting anything imminent on that front. And I think Red Bull may well try to time that out till the end of the season, just to see if Alex can build up some momentum that's been lacking.
Indeed. And it's just interesting going back to what you're saying about Ferrari and Mick Schumacher. That's basically the wait for the title to be wrapped up or see how things progress down the line, was basically what Ferrari did with Charles Leclerc back in 2017 when he won the Formula 2 championship. I can remember when I was covering that series, I'd either go up to him in the paddock or I'd ring him up and I'd say, oh, do you mind if we have a quick chat? And he was like, as long as it's not about Formula 1, if it's just about Formula 2, fine, not about Formula 1. I was like, okay, well, as I'm the F2 correspondent, I shall ask you about that championship then. But there we go. Right, guys, thank you very much for coming on the podcast this morning, and thanks to everybody listening along. Now, just before we go, we'd like to remind you that the latest issue of Autosport magazine comes out on Thursday and will be available on the supermarket shelves and in newsagents, as well as on the doormats of subscribers. There'll be a new issue of the magazine for you to pick up every Thursday, packed full of news, analysis, and the usual stunning photography. And of course, if you want unlimited access to Autosport from the comfort of your home, visit autosport.com/plus to find out how to subscribe to our digital package. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Autosport Podcast.